What if you could design your own dental implant system from scratch? What would you change? Less complexity? Better bone preservation? Simpler digital workflows? A price that actually makes sense? That's exactly what Biotech Dental created with the Contact Dental Implant System. Contact implants promote osseointegration, preserve crestal bone, and simplify your implant procedures. With a single prosthetic connection, streamlined surgical kits, and seamless integration into digital workflows, the Contact Dental implant is quickly becoming the go-to choice for U.S. dental professionals. Your cases will be supported by a dedicated planning team who can provide surgical guides and answer any technical questions. Experience the difference firsthand. Biotech Dental will provide your first contact implant case completely free, including restorative components and surgical planning support. Clinically proven, intuitively designed, surprisingly affordable, discover why so many dentists are switching to the contact implant system. Visit biotechdentalusa.com to learn more.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
People, welcome back to another episode of the Knife Talk Podcast. Craig is not with us, so we don't have all our fancy jingles and sound clips and stuff, so we're just going to be cruising. What is that? Unplugged? Acapella? What do we call it?
Well, I mean, we're not acapella. I mean, and I was almost going to say we're raw-dogging it, but I think that was too gross, too.
Raw-dog has been getting thrown around a little bit too much lately, too.
Way too much.
Anyways, Knife Talk is a podcast all about knives. We're here to answer questions, help you troubleshoot some of your processes. We're here to talk about life and knives and share dilemmas and just kind of help pass the time, help you not feel all by your lonesome on your commute, in the shop, wherever you might be, and as well as trying to help give you put a smile on your face every once in a while. I am Marco Malmasi of Malmasi Fire Arts. I am here with Jeff Fader of Fader Knives. Unfortunately, Craig cannot join us. I think there's stuff going on with his kids. His kids got in surgery, so he is busy getting wasted right now.
Wait a second.
Am I supposed to say that?
Well, no. Let me clean this up a little bit because I'm the one who gets the messages. The family's fine. Everybody's fine. Yeah. They're getting a very simple procedure done. Everybody's fine. But he is getting drunk as we speak. He just called me the C word.
Cunt.
And text. Yeah, that's what he did. He called me that just now. So he's getting drunk on the minibar while we're, you know, taking care of biz. So,
you know what's interesting?
Go ahead.
About the word cunt. Obviously, in other countries, you don't like it. You don't like it. Other countries, they throw it around a lot.
Yeah.
What's interesting is people will throw around the word cock without even batting an eye.
Yeah. Just,
both of those words were coined at the exact same time, but because one is related to a woman's anatomy, it becomes a horrible fucking thing to say.
Well, you know, I mean, P.S.
I'm not advocating for its use. I'm just saying.
Fine. I understand.
Let's be free in understanding of words.
I understand. Feel free to, for the listeners who usually blame me for the foul language, that was not me. That first 2 minutes was not me whatsoever. So,
foul language is a social construct.
All right. Okay. Here we go.
It's an agreement among people that certain words are bad and certain words are good. Let's just say words are words.
Mm.
That's on you to take it personally.
How have you been, Mareko?
That's your choice. I'm all right. This last week, holy shit. So last episode, we talked about me doing a bunch of live streams. I've been up to my eyeballs, as you would say, in live streams. It's been good, though. I think I clocked like 10 hours of live streams.
Oh, my God.
In the last few days.
Jeez.
It's good. No, it's good. It's almost like a layer or a level of accountability in a way to get shit done, because I'm filming stuff to eventually edit and share with people as a in an educational format. But initially, it's pretty rough and raw as a live stream. And I appreciate everybody's support coming and hanging out. I appreciate the Patreon folks for joining and being part of the calamity and the excitement and all the shit that's going on with this build, because I'm forging steel, and instead of it going perfectly smooth, which I think my perfectionist mindset would say, oh, everything's got to go perfect and smoothly, but a lot of bad shit has been happening along the way, and I've had to pivot. I started with one pattern design idea, and from the get-go, things were kind of getting fucked up, and I had to do corrections, and I've been able to salvage the steel so far. I haven't finished making it, but I recovered, but not before a lot of things, like it threatened to come apart on me multiple times. which can be devastating in regards to just the cost of the material, let alone, because I think in most of my starting stacks, the starting billet is probably about $120 to $150 in material of carbon steel. Of course, prices may vary depending on your resource, but yeah. And then I got to 2 days ago, on Tuesday, on the second day, it looked like things were starting to come apart again in this second stack and reweld. And so Wednesday, yesterday, as we were recording on Thursday of last week, I was able to salvage everything. And so the material has come together. I think it's going to be real good going forward. Of course, there's always the opportunity that shit might go sideways again. But I'm trying to stay positive and just trying to kind of roll with it. Instead of being too fixed in what I had in my mind in making this pattern, because of when you have a lot of experience in making steel and have had a lot of successes, it's easy, I think, to think that everything's going to go great, when the reality is, even with as much experience and skill as you have, things can still go sideways. And so I've been learning that lesson. I've been learning the lesson of patience and pivoting along the way. So now I've pivoted twice, I think, right now in regards to how I'm making this pattern. And it's good, though. And then before that, last Saturday, after we recorded, I had the knife sharpening competition down in Portland, hosted by our friend Sean Houston. He's Triple B over on Instagram. And as well as hosted by Steelport Knives, which is owned by Eitan Sias. He also owns the Phoenix Knife House, as well as the Portland Knife House, the cutlery stores. And it was super fun. We had six of us. Our friend Matt Coons of Two Point Sharpening took first place. Wow. But man, I'll tell you, I was super anxious.
Why?
Oh, and our friend from Acre Forge, Ryan Cavallo, he had the lowest scoring knife, which is a good thing. It's like golf. You're trying to get the lowest score. He had the lowest scoring knife of the day with an average of 80 on the best tester. Anyways.
Why are you anxious?
Because, to be fair, I haven't fully sharpened a knife from dull in 2 years. That's why.
Well, I thought you did the whole farm stand thing.
No, I'm sharp. I use my machine when I sharpen.
Oh, so it was only
stones. Yeah. So you had 10 minutes to sharpen. So what they do is they present you with two different style knives. So the first knife is a VG10, which is a stainless high carbon steel knife, which is very wear resistant and difficult to sharpen. They give you 10 minutes to sharpen that knife. And then they put it through the best tester, which is basically like a little tiny scale with a filament, and that looks like basically floss, like tooth floss.
Right.
And it measures the amount of force that's required, Or yeah, yeah. I think I don't know what the weight is. I think it might be in grams though.
Sorry.
Or whatever. Right. Anyways, you can look it up. Triple B's got all the info. Anyways, and you take measurements across three different points, basically out from the an inch from the heel, an inch from the tip, and one right in the middle, and then you average those, and that gives you an idea of the sharpness of that knife. Now, I guess commercially manufactured knives have a typical sharpness of about 150 to 200 on a best tester, like straight from the company. And the winner, Matt Coons, his average was 92 on his first knife, I believe.
Huh.
Killed it. And like I said, Ryan got an 80 on his second knife. So the second knife was Shirigami 2 or whatever, the white paper steel, which is not a stainless, but it is a high carbon, high wear resistant, because I think it has a tungsten and vanadium in there as the carbide forming elements, which makes it really hard and very wear resistant. And so then we sharpened those. We also got 10 minutes to sharpen those. Then they scored those. And then they took our first knife and basically scraped the edge off on a stone and then had us resharpen them in 5 minutes. And then we tested all those. And then the person with the best score across all three rounds, average score across all three rounds, was the winner. Ooh. And it was cool. It was fun. But it was stressful. And there were people standing around watching. But it was really cool because at the Portland, or what? No, it's at Steelport, at the Steelport Warehouse, Steelport Knife Company, they had... Eitan has started like a collective of knife making companies. And so Kershaw was there, Gerber was there, Leatherman was there, all these companies that are based out of Portland. Who's it? James Knives was there. Fuck, I can't remember everybody, but there were a bunch of different knife companies there. And it was really great to see those knives and see those companies and talk to some of those people. They also had some food people there doing smash burgers. They had, thankfully, they probably a good move. They had an NA beer distributor there, as well as Freem beer company. And it was cool. It was a fun event. But I kind of like, it's a 2-hour drive for me. And so I drove down. I did the thing. I got there like 30 minutes before it started. And then I hung out for a little bit with our friend Jeremy Spake was there, Mr. Road to Victory. So I hung out and chatted with him a bit, and then I had to actually get back. So I was there for 2.5 hours and then drove 2 hours back. Back up to Olympia.
Well, you did a nice job, though. It sounded like it was a good event.
Yeah. Yeah, I got second. And I'm not mad about that because a professional sharpener got first. And the professional sharpener 2 years ago when Sean hosted this event last also won first place. So
yeah, if he don't win, if a professional sharpener don't win, you got to pack it in, right?
For sure.
Pack it in time, right?
The fucking knife maker beat me. But I think, honestly, like it was interesting. It was cool because most of the guys actually that were there are professional sharpeners. It was just me and Ryan that were knife makers.
So what set theirs apart from yours? What is a professional knife sharpener doing differently than you, who make knives for a living and know how to make them sharp?
Well, I know how to make them sharp as a knife maker, but it's like specializing in anything. Matt has way more years on me and way more hours on me when it comes to knives, especially stone sharpening. He's got hundreds, if not thousands, of hours.
So there's not like a couple little details that you could pick out that would
there's nuances. So the difficulty in stone sharpening, especially when you're freehand stone sharpening, is consistency of angle. And when you have lots and lots of reps and hours of work in stone sharpening, you develop that consistency.
Right.
I haven't fully stone sharpened a knife in over 2 years. The last time I stone sharpened a knife was probably 4 or 5 months ago. And so I don't have those reps. So there's slight nuance. And so we had stones that were 400, 800, 3000, and then a diamond paste, which was like a micrometer for a strop, for just polishing the edge and deburring and polishing the edge at the very end. And If you can't keep that angle consistent from the even just from the 400, the coarsest stone, to the 800, you're not sharpening potentially the same apex, or if you're even hitting it. And the goal of, and the way to get a highly refined, sharp apex is by hitting that angle every fucking time. And there were definitely, and what was cool is Sean has a couple of little devices. One, you can kind of, it's like a little circle. It looks like a 2-inch cut of like a 4-inch PVC tube. And it's got the angle reader in there with the laser pointer like attached. And you shoot the laser at the edge and it deflects the laser on off the sharpening edge. And then it can tell you what the angle is from side to side of the knife. And then the other one was a video microscope. And I think it got up to, I think we were reading or looking at stuff up to like 600 times or something like that.
Wow.
But it was really cool to be able to actually see the apex of the knife where like maybe what is 1/8 of an inch is like 4 inches wide on a little screen. Wow. And so you really get a good look at what is happening on your edge. Or
you get to see all the fucking dirty laundry.
I did math wrong. If I did see, yeah, exactly. Well,
you get to see all the bullshit under your bed.
For sure. Well, and I could. So what I could see is there were a couple spots where I had missed the angle, and so I was close behind him, but ultimately Matt ended up winning. I got second, and I think Ryan actually got third. And then the rest of the sharpeners kind of followed as they did, but it was fun. It was cool. But I think there's a Sean. I think ultimately would like this sharpening competition to actually be part of Blade Show, because I think as much as knife makers love to make knives and can make them sharp, the question is like how truly sharp are they actually making them? And it's just kind of a fun way to play. And it's not meant to like shame anybody or put anybody down. It's about just trying to help encourage people to think about their sharpening. And I think it's really cool that he's doing this. And I believe that there is honestly a pretty severe disparity between knife makers and their knowledge and true understanding and knowledge of what sharp means. Now, but for chef's knives and Hardy's knives, you don't necessarily have to take knives to this extreme sharpness. Like, the only knife that really needs to be that sharp is probably, like, a sushi knife and, a straight razor. But outside of that, like, very few knives have to be insanely sharp like this.
But this is experience. Once again, it's like, yes. I mean, it comes from experience.
What is experience?
You say, you know, like knife makers not knowing sharp. I mean, it just, there's always a learning curve in terms of how much you're going to put into what your product.
Nobody knows sharp. I think even with as much experience as I have, I'm always curious and interested and know that I have a lot more to learn and understand. And so I just think, yeah. I'm not trying to put anybody down.
No, I know you're not. I know you're not. No,
I think it's a fool, and honestly, somebody who is depriving themselves of further education, understanding, and wisdom, who thinks they fucking know it all. So it's just, I think it's also trying to help people, you know, be thoughtful and reflecting in what do I actually know and understand, and where is there room for improvement.
Well, if this was being a part of Blade Show, I can imagine it would be an easy sell. I mean, they are doing those Bally Song flipping competitions. I would think a sharpness competition would be, you know, an easy sell. But what the hell do I know?
Well, yeah. And while the trick, I think it would be a great sell. The tricky part is that the best testing is kind of it takes time. It's kind of takes a lot of time. And so I think it would require some like preliminary some preliminary rounds of some sort to kind of narrow down the field to like maybe 6 guys up on the stage or wherever sharpening knives, because otherwise it's gonna take for fucking ever to measure every single round. It'd be ridiculous. It took like 15 to 20 minutes each round to measure all the knives.
Oh yeah, no one's sticking around for that.
When it took 10 minutes to just do the sharpening.
Oh dude, no one's sticking around for that. No one's sitting in a chair for that. I mean, just like, I mean, give me a break. We'll walk around. We'll get some Chick-fil-A or something. And then I'll
do that. One thing that potentially could be interesting would be Like if it was like a rotational thing, like people who are interested in and potentially entering the competition, you could swing by a booth, sharpen up, like be timed, sharpen a knife, and then you're doing on, and then they take the reading and they keep track of a live chart and whatever.
That's a great idea.
Like a spreadsheet, and then people can come sharpen as they like throughout the day if they think they want to compete, and then the top whatever, maybe it's only three motherfucking knife makers, top three compete for the best knife sharpener.
That's an excellent way to do it. You get a booth and then you sharpen and then they rate you and they put you on a board and then you wander around and then they make the results and then they bring the top three in. That's the way to do it. Otherwise, I mean, no one's going to be watching people scritching and scratching at while they're sitting down in a chair. Crazy.
Well, if you're going to try to get a knife sharp, what are you going to do?
I'm going to go to Tormek. Are you crazy? I'm going to go to Tormek.com, Tormek_sharpening on Instagram. I'm going to see those guys at some point soon. They're a great company making water-cooled sharpening systems, and they're going to make sure that when you use those water-cooled sharpening systems, they'll have your angles for you. They'll help you with your angles, and then they're going to help you take away material in the smartest way possible without any undercutting, ladies and gentlemen. No undercutting. You don't get undercuts when you're using the Tormek, so go to Tormek.com. See what the fuss is about.
That's it. Good, and that's what I was talking about, consistency of angle.
Yeah.
If you're not hitting that same angle every time, you're undercutting, which means you're actually not hitting the apex. You're hitting kind of like that shoulder between the sharpening bevel and the...
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax tip and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Face of the blade, right?
There you go.
Or overcutting would be going too steep then. And then you're all kind of blunting the knife. So consistency of angles, crucial.
Look at you. Look at you. You're a sharpening wizard, and you had a good birthday.
Yeah. No, I had a great birthday. What did I do for my birthday?
Oh,
I
went... You were here, you went mushroom farming, and then you came over here, and foraging. Then you were going to go out for sushi.
Yeah, sushi was great. Sadly, well, I don't know if it's sad, but my kid is fucking obsessed with sushi now, so I got to be careful about how often we go, because we're going to be racking up the bills pretty goddamn quick.
There you
go. Real fun.
You got to get your knife into one of the hands of your favorite sushi guy. So then you get the sushi.
He already has one.
So then you're sending you a roll or two. You know
what?
You got to send you a roll, a couple of sushi rolls. You got to prime the pump so the bill ain't so high.
I got you.
You know,
that's a good call.
There you go.
All right. How you been? Well, how's the last week been?
Good. I'm looking forward to talking about what's been going on in the world, only because it's been like I've been on the texting with Lawrence Lake over Maritime Knife Supply and talking to our friends in Australia. But in the meantime, we're going to get to that. But you're not going to believe this, but I was actually at an audition today. A casting company reached out to me about being in a commercial.
Oh, really?
So I auditioned for a commercial today. Yeah, they reached out.
Okay.
They needed.
Is it for laxatives? What's it for?
Yeah, you know, I thought. You know what? The funny thing is I thought you were going to do one about adult diapers. I thought you were going to say that. No, I can't. I guess I can't talk about it.
I didn't want to hit it too close to home. But
oh yeah, thank yeah. I'm the demographic for what did you say? Laxatives. So they were looking for blacksmiths. They were looking for like the company it looks for like authentic metal workers and not metal workers but authentic people. So they. They came across our thing, sent us a message, and then we sent them a thing, and then I did the audition today. And it's for some boot company. I don't know anything about it other than they wouldn't tell me anything more than that. So,
but, they didn't tell you what company it was?
I'm gonna, apparently, if I get accepted, I got to sign NDA agreements and all this shit. So, but they're looking for someone in the tri-state area, and they reached out to me. And I'm like, I mean, you find a blacksmith in the tri-state area that's going to be able to make it on these particular dates. It'd be amazing. So... Yeah, I had a really nice conversation. Talked about my history and shown. I put together a sizzle reel of me. They wanted to see me forging, so I did a quick sizzle reel of that. And I, and then I got in the car to talk to get ready for you recording. And then my business partner heard about it, and he goes, you're a sellout. And I was just like, Jesus Christ, what? Tony, we got to make some money. This company's got to make some money somehow. This is, you know, with everything, we got to make a little extra dough. So,
yeah.
So if I get it, you know, who knows? Could be hilarious, or it could be, or I won't get it. In my mind, I thought at the very least, I have some content for the pod, one of the two podcasts you can talk about. So, you know, we'll see how far I go. But that's all I know. They said I did great. I'll know after Labor Day. This is the Knife Talk Labor Day special. And we're here with you on Labor Day. But what else? And then, you know, we're doing work. We're doing work. We are this we got a contracts all signed for to do this these prototypes for this company, and that's really great. I didn't expect it to happen, if I'm being honest. And we're gonna start it with them as soon as I said I'm not touching shit until the first check shows up. So once we're gonna I'm looking forward to getting that. It'll be fun. And then you know, we're getting ready for the fall, fixing our inventory up a little bit, and then blah blah blah.
I got you.
Nothing else.
Oh, you know what? Talking about the fall, remind me of the leaves changing and how a few years ago, after Maker Camp, went for a nice drive through New England and saw the leaves changing and went through all of the wooded bridges that we could find in fucking Vermont. Vermont is gorgeous, by the way.
Mm. There you go. Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm with you. Bridges in Madison County. I'm with you. Yeah. I'm 100%. I don't really like the fall, frankly. So I'm
really.
Yeah, it's the precursor to the winter, and I don't like the winter. So it's like I like the spring because it's the precursor for the summer. So, frankly, the only thing I'm enjoying about the fall now is this is the end of summer brings on the U.S. Open. So we're watching tennis every night, and that's always been as that's I was growing up.
That's what you're excited about.
I'm not excited about it. I'm not excited about any of it. But I don't really like the fall. But the U.S. Open always was like, I always knew when school was starting because that's when the U.S. Open was. So it's a big New York tennis thing. And we just were watching it. And, you know, it's, I don't know, passing the time.
Well, anyways, the reason I bring up the fall in Vermont and stuff, not only is because you're talking about it, but I'm not going to be at Maker Camp this year.
Oh, no?
I'm really sad.
Oh, yeah, I guess some
things are getting changed up, and I'm not gonna be there.
All right, well we'll toast one for you. We'll toast one.
I'll miss all the people.
We're gonna miss you too. Always,
well, and what's even worse is like the dude's super fucking bummed.
Yeah,
and yeah, right, but it's hard to like outside of being a demonstrator, it's hard. It's like coming. I'm probably one of maybe a small handful of people coming out from the West Coast. And it's fucking expensive to get our asses out there.
It's not easy.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I just can't swing it this year.
I've overbooked myself for Maker Camp, so I'm doing something with the guys, and then I'm doing something with Total Boat. So I'd love to worm my way out of it. I'm supposed to do a heavy run on that Saturday too. So I'm not really, I'm looking forward to it, but it's like, if I could worm my way out of it, I would try.
I got you.
Yeah. I love worming my way out of things. It's legitimately, that might've been one of the, I mean, I hate to bring it down, but when my sister died, worming my way out of things was like a fucking added bonus. That was like, I mean, that was legitimately, I had a good 2 weeks of squirming out of things, you know, proudly. I didn't even have to squirm. I ducked out, and I had a great excuse, and now, that exit door is out. So
yeah.
And with that said, guys, if you need, don't squirm your way out of heat treatment, you know what I'm saying? You got to go to evenheat-kiln.com. The Knife Talk is sponsored by Even Heat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. Evenheat-kiln.com. Don't squirm your way out of good heat treatment. You know what I'm saying? All right. Well, that was fun. Well, we have questions from our loyal listeners. When we get to Maritime Knife Supply, we have to kind of dip into what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
Because he's got a big announcement. But we have some audio messages. And why don't we start in? Why don't you give us a start in on the... Oh, guys. So if you want to send us a message, you send us an audio message. You want to send us a question, send us feedback, whatever. I'm still hoping you guys are going to send me from last week some KTP, GTP emails that were to interpret. If you listen to last week's episode, we are ready to interpret the email that you don't understand from your weird customers. It's called KTP GTP. Send it to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. I'm desperate for that.
Yeah. That was pretty funny last week. All right. Yeah. This one is from Samuel Wandishin.
That's good. You met him.
Did I hit it?
You did a good job. Keep reading.
Okay. Howdy, KTP. I've been so busy lately. Wish I had more time to spend with friends or in the shop. If there was 30 hours in a day, what would you like to add to your schedule? Also, it was good to meet you in Minneapolis, Marco. And Jeff, I was indeed listening when you butchered my last name. Ha ha ha. It rhymes with gone fishing. Oh, Wandishin. Gone fishing.
What did I say? I don't remember what I said. This is something probably sing-songy and bullshit, most likely. Sam's a good dude. So you got 30 hours. You got extra hours in the day. What would you do?
I would start off with some fucking quality sleep. Then I would follow that with a morning stretching and meditation session. And then I would follow that with some exercise and then probably a little bit of stretching after that. And then a good breakfast to feel those muscles I just beat the shit out of.
Wow.
Answer some emails.
Wow.
Do some visiting with the family.
Oh my God, you're adding that's 5 hours? Sounds like you're running out of the 5 hours.
What? It's 6 hours, by the way.
6 hours. You're running out of six. You're running out of 6 hours. No.
And then I would go to work.
Like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
What about you?
I'm squeezing more time into my day, and it's the hardest part of my Wednesdays because I have a long run on Wednesday mornings, and this week started the longer run. I had to run 7 miles yesterday morning before work, and then I wake up, I get everything squared away, I get my wife out the door, go to the bathroom. You cannot run without without the morning constitutional. Don't work. Ran 7 miles, so I got to run 7 miles next Wednesday. Wednesday mornings just blow, and then I had to run back, get the dogs for a walk, and then get to the shop on time. It's a drag, but if I were to add more time to my day, I've been actually specifically working on very small sculpture, quick sculpture, so I would be doing more sculpture by a mile. That's not even, and when I first read this, I was just like, yeah, you're going to make some sculpture. So I actually already finished
six hours. 6 hours of sculpture?
Oh, I don't know what else to add. I mean, I'd love to just, spend more time making sculpture. And I already made two small sculptures that I really like. And I'm working on a big one, a 7-foot sculpture that I started like 2 years ago. I'm back on that. And that's pretty good. Sold some sculptures relatively recently, which is crazy. Blah, blah, blah. There you go. There you go. Make some more sculpture.
You sold sculptures that you already had or sculptures
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I had an old customer bumped into a friend of his, and he had some of my sculpture, and they said, "Where did you get that?" And then they got a hold of me, came to the shop.
He bumped into a friend carrying your sculpture?
He went to my customer's house. Okay. And then he said, "Where did you get those?"
It seems like a little bit more than bumping into him.
Well, I gotta tell everything.
Who cares? Doesn't matter. At his house.
He reached out, and then
was the sculpture
he
in his car or in his backpack? Sorry,
yeah,
go ahead.
Whatever, cares. So he saw my sculpture. He contacted me, and he came to my shop, and he bought some sculpture off the wall. It was pretty great.
That's great.
So then I might do some more for him at some point, which would be nice. So give me some more time. I'm making sculpture.
You know, if you use the AI to write the mapping program, you could get those sculptures CNC'd, and then you just got to paint them out. You could do that, right?
Yeah, my audio just cut out. I'm glad I didn't hear what you just said. I have no interest in that. Why would I do that? That's the most fun part about it. You're making a joke, I hope, right?
yes, absolutely.
That's the most fun about making sculpture. Yeah, look, AI, everyone loves it. They're freaking out with AI.
You're designing it still. You just don't have... Maybe you don't have the skill.
Do you like what you do?
Sometimes.
All right. Well, the times you do like it. Let's just say the times that you do like it. You wouldn't get somebody else to or something else to do the parts that you like, right?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
If I could get rid of like the handle sculpting and the blade grinding, all right, I'd be happy.
Well, I like all the sculpture is the one thing, and I like everything about it. And I like being by myself, and I like kind of struggling, and I wouldn't ask for help at all. Even when I had interns, the help that they would get
whoa,
would
whoa,
be.
Whoa, you had sculpture interns?
Yeah, back in the day, yeah, for years. I used to work with a high school, and I used to get high school interns for years.
You get the little boys in, and what would they do?
They would clean the shop up. Maybe they'd do some sanding. They would do some. We would paint stuff, and yeah, they were. I believe in interns.
How does that work?
What do you mean? How does it
work? I know you're not paying them, but if they're like busy sweeping the floor and you're working, like they're not really observing you working, are they?
This is the biggest problem. This is the biggest misconception people don't understand about. And this is something that knife makers could learn from too. When I was an art major, I wanted to be an artist. And my father said to me is if you want to be an artist, you have to work with artists. And what you do is you call them up. This is back in the early 90s. And then you get a job doing whatever, sweeping the floors, doing whatever. And then you're part of you're working around these people, and then you're able to kind of become an assistant, but you're doing things with them, and you're learning how to live like an artist. And I learned a lot. I was an intern for six different artists in college, and I would never have done any of this stuff. And it was very important to me. So I would I had a contact at the high school in our town, and then there would be art students, and they would send me a message saying, "Hey, this kid wants to be an artist. Do you need any interns?" And I would say, "Sure." And then I'd have interns here, and then we would, depending on a project that I was working on, you know, I mean, it's not just all sweeping the floors, but I mean, it's like it's a valuable part of learning about a craft is working alongside someone and kind of getting more. You're not getting paid, but you learn what's going on. So I've been involved with internship programs forever. I had internships here at Fader Knives in the beginning, and I think they're invaluable for young people. I think they're especially people who want to learn how to do something. I think that internships are probably the most important thing you can do.
Sure. Is that different from like having an apprentice, would you say?
Yeah, because an apprentice is you. I mean, I don't get involved with you know the logistics of the differences between an intern and a. I go by my old ways of when I was a sculptor when I had interns, but I don't know from apprentice. People say, "Do you have apprentices?" And I don't even know what that means. Like they're gonna. I'm the master, and they're the apprentice, and then they're gonna. I don't do that shit. You're gonna come in here after school and work with me on these projects. We'll do it. Okay. Teach them how to use the tools and all this stuff. It's very valuable for young people to have an internship.
Okay.
Where were we?
I don't know. I completely derailed it.
Yeah, you did totally derailed. Totally derailed.
I'd hear that thrown around. Intern.
Yeah.
I'm just like, what does that actually mean? Because I've never had experience to that kind of work.
But I mean, my kid had an internship with her college where she was working along, you know, in doing internships with her, with something involved with her major. And they're meant to be on the educational side. Sometimes they're paid, sometimes they're not. And, you know, I had some bad internship experiences, and I had some great internship experiences, but it's like, it's meant to give you real world experience. And usually what happens is if you're an intern long enough, they usually hire you. So, you know, be an artist assistant or whatever. So I was an intern for some, you know, pretty heavy duty artists. And it was when I was doing it, it was like, it was a lot more than just sweeping the floor. Yeah. But there was days where I had to go get lunch for people and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Fernandez Forge says, "I don't think we talk enough about the ups and downs of what we do. Making a few sales will have you floating on air and super pumped. Yet all it takes is a show or two with no sales to have you questioning your value and life choices. I guess I'm a collector now, and I'm tired of them just being Christmas presents." So,
what do you think about that?
I think that we have other show questions coming up. I think that the biggest problem right now, that especially, you know, the difference between a hobbyist knife maker and someone who's really going to see this as a business and a profession is I think that we get a little bit too, we're not looking far enough into the future. Okay. That's the biggest issue I see with a lot of knife makers, especially, is they're, you know, they're hanging their hat on something very, you know, net right now, as opposed to investing in the future of their business. So I think that you have to make it, I think that the shows are great, and I think a lot of people really get really, you know, do really well with them, but you have to just make a decision whether or not the juice is worth the squeeze. Right. Some guys, I remember I was talking to a lot of guys at Blade Show this year, and some guys did great, and some guys did terrible. Some guys did so bad that they're like, I'm not doing this again. And you have to make the decision of like, is this direction of, you know, some days are good and some days are bad, is it worth it? Is it, are the pros outweighing the cons? And then you make a business decision and a leadership decision to say, is it worth my time doing this anymore? And I think that that's the bigger issue, as opposed to like, I think that, you know, look, being a business and being a leader of your own company is a little bit harder than I think people want it, people realize. And I think that a lot of the stuff that they don't like to do, they're avoiding, and I think it's a huge mistake. And we're going to talk about that when we get to maritime. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think it definitely takes a bit of reflecting, but I think it wouldn't be a good idea to just say knife shows in general are bad. It could just be the wrong show for you. Like for the knives that I make and I sell, if I were to start holding a booth at the local farmer's market and trying to sell knives, I wouldn't fucking sell anything. Ever.
Oh, ever.
And
ever.
If I were to take that as a symptom of me not being worthy, then I would probably quit making knives pretty quickly.
Jump off a bridge. But the reality, make the joke, but that's the truth. If you go to a fucking knife show, you go to a farmer's market with like a, you know, a $900 knife, everyone's just going to be making noises.
Right. So I think evaluating the platform is really important. I don't think it's not the best move to take it personally. I think, you know, even if I took my knives to the fucking SHOT Show down in Las Vegas, that again would also probably not be the best show for me, because that show is focused around guns and tactical knives, and I think the people that are probably, or a majority of the people are going to that, are not interested in culinary knives. But even Blade Show, honestly, like more and more people are becoming interested in culinary knives, but even Blade Show probably is not the best show for culinary knife makers.
Right.
Now, our friend Quentin Middleton's a fucking genius, and he's had it dialed in a long time ago, but he's doing like food and wine events with the culinary knives. And he's like, when he goes there, like there's probably some ding dong selling Cutco or somebody else selling Wusthof, peddling Wusthof, but there are no custom knife makers there. He's the only custom knife maker. And so he has a captive audience, and it's fucking genius. And he's been doing it for years. So I think evaluating your choice in regards to where you are displaying your items and putting your knives up for availability and kind of presenting yourself is also a really good idea, but to take the time to do that. Because even if I were to take my kitchen knives into a knitting store, even if as fancy and boutique as it might be, if I were to put my what the hell
Sorry.
Was that
nothing
if I were to put my knives it. Up in there, that's probably not the best place for me to be trying to peddle my knives, but sell my work, right?
You got to find your demographic, guys.
You got to dial it in. Yeah, you got to find your demographic and try not to take it too personally. But as makers, as creative people, as people who are putting our blood, sweat, and tears and our time into and creativity into making these things, it is hard for us not to, I guess, identify them as an aspect of ourselves and therefore not take it personally when things don't sell or move as quickly as we would like them to.
Or you need to look at the data from going to these events and making a tactical decision in regards to what you should be doing. Yeah. Where's your time better spent? Instead of hoping. That's the biggest problem. The biggest problem I see is there's a lot of hope. And hope is for the fucking
A lot of people got their fucking fingers crossed.
Yeah. Dude, hope is for the weak. Hope is like...
I don't know about...
Well, for in a situation where you have the ability to...
Maybe the context like this? Yeah, sure. It's not the greatest strategy.
Hope is a strategy is terrible. It's not a strategy at all. It's like luck. It's like, well, let's hope that luck does it. I mean, obviously, there are certain things that you take advantage of, but hope is not one of them. And you have to make a decision being like, this sucks, I'm not doing this again. Or maybe this will be better next year, but we'll find out. But it's like, actually, you know what? I want to play this audio message from our man, Tai Ming, who talks about, that's what I was trying to grab, because I think it's pertinent to our conversation.
Let's hear it.
This is Tai Ming. He sent an audio message in regards to this. He went to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram, and here is Tai.
Hey, this is Tai, and last weekend I was at the New York Custom Knife Show, and a maker said to me that, the table at Blade was, would cost, his portion would cost a couple thousand dollars, and it had me, and that's why he didn't go to Atlanta, which had me wondering what your guys' thoughts are on knife shows and their uses to both kind of community, seeing other work, and also as a business proposition. Okay, thanks.
Ty's the man. Love timing. Yeah. Timing in his Instagram handle is, we say timing, but his Instagram handle is timing isn't everything. Fucking good. Ty's the man.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes along with what we're already
saying.
Yeah, and I bet, especially, I don't know, some of the bigger shows, if they collected data from the makers or took surveys, which they don't, but if they took surveys from the people who hold tables or booths at the show, I think they would find that very few of the custom makers or handmade knife makers are doing well. And there are lots of bigger knife companies, purveyors, commercial manufacturers who go to a Blade show and they fucking crush. Like, they're walking out of there with millions of dollars. Yeah. And there are plenty of makers who are now out anywhere from a couple thousand to plus in regards to cost of housing when you travel, cost of food when you travel, cost of actually fucking traveling, renting a car if you need to rent a car. Everything in between, between your house and the event, and then you're sitting there and you're trying to reevaluate. Okay, I didn't sell a fucking knife. Was this worth the trip? And it's sometimes can be really hard to quantify it in sales because most makers don't do super great in sales at knife shows. I know some do, but I think majority of makers recently are not doing so well.
Can I postulate something that might be unpopular?
Let's hear it.
Talking to a lot of those guys, and they're friends of ours, probably some of them listen to the show right now, is it possible that they take for granted the fact that they have to move their ass to make sure the customers are there? I don't do it because I always say it's like selling hamburgers at a hamburger convention. It's like, why would I want to put myself through that? But the other thing is, if I was going to do it, I'll tell you what I'd do. I would make sure that I was priming people for me being down there. And I would be doing everything I can not to, because I feel as though sometimes I'm turning a corner and then there's just a friend of mine who I follow on Instagram and I didn't even know they were going to sell knives there. I didn't even know they were going to be there.
Right.
So if I don't know, then how are potential customers going to know? So like part of me feels as though, and I might be wrong. If I'm wrong, I apologize. I don't think I'm wrong. I mean, I apologize. All right, let's just apologize right now so you don't get mad at me.
Don't apologize.
But I think that a lot of guys feel, a lot of knife makers feel, that when you're doing Blade Show, there's a baked-in audience, and then you're going to reap the rewards of that baked-in audience as opposed to focusing on why you're there and why your customers need to be there to meet you and to get a hold of you and get one of your knives. So what's the difference between that and how, I mean, you know, some people do great. I met a guy who was killing it, and he had a, it was a price point issue. It was like a, it was a very clear under, you know, sub $300 knives. He was killing it. And there were other dudes who were above $600 knives, and they were getting smoked, and they were just like, I ain't doing this again. So it's like, so who's, who, what do? You have the biggest knife show in the world or whatever, country, biggest event in the year. People come from all over the place. How do you make sure that, how do you mitigate this disaster of getting smoked?
Yeah. Well, I think, honestly, the strength of brand and reputation plays a big role for sure. And like you're saying, obviously advertising that you're going to be there. But if you have an audience of 50 people, being at Blade Show probably is not the place for you to go. I think
unless you're doing something that stands out.
Yeah. So you. Yeah. So the people that I think are doing really well at Blade Show are like these large manufacturers. They have a massive following, and this is the place where they offer deals or whatever the fuck, or unique and one of or in limited runs, and the only place to get them are at Blade Show. So they're fanatics are going to be at that event to have an opportunity or a chance at getting that stuff.
Right.
The other people who are doing well, even the highest of the high-end custom knife makers, they're the ones, there are some that do really great and there are some who are struggling. And I think the quality of the execution of your work is not the number one factor. Like you could literally make the best fucking knives. But if you don't have any reputation, you don't have anybody who knows who you are, and you're crossing your fingers hoping you'll be discovered at Blade Show, it's a possibility, but the chance, the likelihood is that you're not, and especially if nobody knows who you are. Now, I will say that going to an event like Blade Show or something like that, especially if you're doing high-level work, is potentially a way to help to develop that, garner that kind of reputation and awareness of your work, especially if you're submitting your or holding a table and able to submit your knives for potentially getting awards and then winning awards. But outside of that, like it's hard if you're not winning awards, that means you're probably if you don't have like an ABS journeyman smith or master smith mark next to your name, it's hard to for make or buyers to walk around and look at your work unless they really know what they're looking at. And most people don't fucking know what they're looking at. They're buying emotionally and not based on the quality of the execution. And so it's hard for them to feel, I think, confident. You're playing with people's confidence or kind of like negotiating people's confidence in spending their hard-earned money on your work. And the question is, why? Why are they doing that?
But then there are guys like Knives by Nuge, JD Custom Knives. They've been going recently in the past couple of years. They have big smiles on their face. They love interacting with people. I think that they do amazing. Seems like they do really well, but at the same time, I think that they like also the networking aspect of it. I think that both those two guys, I think JD Custom Knives and Knives by Nuge are great examples of people who are looking at the long term, the long term of their businesses. So they just, it's just part of the cost of doing business. I know that Knives by Nuge does a lot of stuff, and he reaches out, and he I believe, and I could be wrong, and he'll probably reach out to me sometime. He's a good dude. But I think he sees these events as the cost of doing business in terms of the public relations as well. Yep. This is back to what I was talking to you about before, is that about when we were talking about Fernandez Forge, saying that I don't think that a lot of knife makers, I think knife makers are looking at it as the destination as opposed to just a stopping point in their career. And then they're just like hoping that that one, you know, rest stop of the fucking Blade Show is enough to get them over the hump. And I think that, you know, I don't think that's the case. I think it's like some guys do really well and they're going to keep coming back and they're like, it's worth it because I get to meet sponsors and meet this and meet that. And I get handle material. It's a net, you know, maybe for some guys, they'll break even, or they'll say, all right, well, I don't care. You know, it's all a write-off anyway. And that, it's a net even, and that's fine for me. Yeah. So it just depends on the difference between everybody's direction. I mean, your direction, your business, my direction, my business, Craig's direction, all three of us are very different. So we have way different opinions in regards to this. I just personally, it sounds like for me, it would be a fucking schlep. It would be the biggest schlep. And I would be miserable. I'd be miserable preparing. I'd be miserable having to, I gotta get a fucking banner now. Where the fuck do I do that? And I don't like the way it looks. And I gotta stand there now? Fuck that. To me, it's a giant pain in the ass. And I used to do that with my dad when he had a farmer's market. He'd go to farmer's markets. I hated every second of it. So, like, it is not a business decision that I'm interested in at all. But I like to go there.
But like you said, Knives by Nuge and other folks like that's their bread and butter. They fucking love it. And he honestly, and I think that's a really good point is, like, are you just there to try to sell your work? Or are you getting other value out of the experience? And maybe that helps to quantify doing those shows. But I will say for myself personally, like I've enjoyed the shows a lot more not holding a table.
Right. Right.
And I've tried to make my ability to sell knives not reliant on going to shows. But that does mean that I'm doing more work in other places to put myself out there and create that, again, that brand, that reputation, that desire, that interest for my work. And that's going to be the thing. And if you don't have those things, then your work has to like fit, like you were talking about, kind of like in a general price range that probably is along the lines, unfortunately, with like commercially manufactured stuff. And realistically, obviously, your work takes fucking 10, 20, 30 times as long to make versus the commercial manufacturers. But then also at the same time, like commercial manufacturer can't sell a folding knife for $300 if they haven't built up the reputation around themselves as manufacturers of quality tools to be able to sell a knife at that price point. Otherwise, they're selling it for like $30.
I find it to be interesting, and I think that I like talking the business end because I'm far more I'm a little bit more judgmental about the decisions that a lot of knife makers make in regards to why they do what they do. I think that there's a lot of, actually I want to talk about it soon, but before we get to the next question, and we're going to get into it with Maritime Knife Supply, I'm teasing the Maritime Knife Supply thing because I think that's going to take over the whole show, which I'm appreciative of.
You think people are going to change the fucking channel?
Not at all. It's going to be, this is important shit. This is important shit. Not at all. This is important. This is like, we're going to talk about, you know, the economics and the business. It sounds terrible when I say it. We're going to be talking about dick jokes. So before we talk about dick jokes, let's talk about our friends over at Indasa USA, makers of Rhino-et. This stuff is sick. I just ordered, how much did I order? I ordered a pile. I ordered like a pile of Rhino-et from our guys over at Texas Farrier Supply. And you know what I did? I put in the promo code KNIFETALK10 and it peeled 10% off that order. And boy, when I saw all that money taken off in my shopping cart, I was fired up. And then Evan had it in the mail same day. So I'm a huge fan of Texas Farrier Supply. If you want to get any blacksmith stuff, bladesmith stuff, knife making stuff, farrier stuff, all that stuff, you go to Texas Farrier Supply and you can put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you get 10% off. And then definitely, for sure, get the Indasa Rhino Whip.
Oh, yeah.
Where are we at? Okay. Let's skip that audio message. And why don't we... You want to do some listener feedback, or you want to do another question, or what do you want to do?
I thought you said you were moving to the Maritime. You're drawing it out.
We're gonna do one more thing, and then we're gonna tease it. It's a big deal.
The big tease. I see. You're a dick teasing.
I don't know. You like a lot of privates talk today. A lot of privates talk. All right, listen here. They're gonna do a little listener feedback, guys. Yeah, you want to send some listener feedback? Go to Knife Talk Podcast Instagram. And the first thing comes from our man Jacob Stout. I wanted to give some feedback on Morocco's existential crisis. You guys talked a bit about him making and selling steel and possibly forging blanks, but his hesitation about having his name attached to people's... Did we read this last week?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
I did talk about it last week.
All right. His hesitation with having his name attached to other people's work. I think maybe it would make sense to try doing production runs where Morocco is doing the design, pattern, and forging the stuff he likes, and then paying an employee/employees to do the handle and finish work. That way you would retain creative control of the finished product. You get more work out of the lower price, and you only have to do the stuff you like doing. Just my two cents. I'd be the first to submit an application, by the way. All right, well, number one, Jacob Stout is one who wants to apply for a job. But I'm going to answer for you, I'm just assuming, because I know you the way you do. Jacob, I don't think Morocco wants to have any employees.
Employees are expensive.
Right now. Well, I mean... they're only expensive if you're not selling work. You know, if you're selling, if you're using them to help, you know, sell stuff, then they're worth
it. Okay.
I mean, I just don't think you want employees.
I don't know. I'm just, yeah, I guess I've never really been in a place where hiring somebody is going to scale the business in a way that makes sense. And so, yeah.
I mean, not for right me, now. It's for me at this point, I've had David for like 3 years and it's gotten us out. It's gotten me out of the hole of the custom knife list. And then I have inventory. So for me, it's been like invaluable in terms of getting us squared away. But look, some people just, it's not for some people. And when he's right, when it's the right time, it's the right time. Zachary Brahman says, Zachary Brahman says, just heard a question on the podcast about a knife for carving cocktail ice. The ice is typically frozen very slowly in a cooler, so there is a large chunk to cut off. It's done this way to make very clear, air-free ice blocks. That said, the bartenders I've always worked with in restaurants have always used a cheap serrated Dexter knife for carving purposes. This would usually first score the surface, then tap the spine of the knife with a wooden mallet or block to cleave the ice blocks. So. And then, all right, so there you go. Our first Christmas party Tony and I went to, it was just me and Tony at the time, our Christmas party for Fader Knives. Took him down to St. Mark's place. There's this place we used to like to all the time. It was called Yakitori Taisho. And it was this, you know, yakitori joint. And there was a Japanese bar above. And Tony's like, let's go up there. And there was this dude in this Japanese bar. And he said, oh, we have to have this Japanese whiskey. I'm like, all right, frankly, fine, go ahead. He took this block of ice and he started chopping it up. And this is like, I mean, you know, this could have been 9 years ago or something like that, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And he's chomping it up and there's ice chips going up fucking everywhere. And he puts this fucking monstrous diamond of ice in the cup, puts this whiskey in there. And I'm just like, bro, it's all fucking ice. It's a fucking giant iceberg in there. I'm like, what the fuck happened? They're like cutting these. I got ice chips all over me. I got to get a windshield wiper on me. Scrape that fucking scrape down from all the fucking ice chips everywhere. So,
yeah, it's, I don't know. I would have to do a bit of research to really understand how it's being used.
Mm.
Yeah.
Dustin Sheffield says, for all the fans that get mad about some of your weirdo suggestions / shows that we were talking about, people get mad at that Craig likes to offer up his opinion on shows, and they're usually very ghoulish. Let's not forget Craig's original suggested show. Please book Joe Exotic for a podcast. Do you remember how obsessed he was with the Tiger King?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, my God.
I still have never seen that show.
Yeah, you're better off. You're way better off without it.
It makes me sad.
What did you say?
Animals being treated that way makes me
sad. Oh, dude, it's all so ghoulish. It's just... ghoulish is the right word. I hate all that stuff. I'm just like not interested whatsoever. But you know what I am interested in are our friends at Maritime Knife Supply. Knife Supply is your one-stop shop for knife makers, belts, abrasives, steels, handle, forges, presses, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. They're in Canada and they ship to with ease in the United in Canada, but we have something to talk about.
Okay. What's going on?
So, Lawrence sent me a message. I've been talking to him for the past week about all this. This is what he wrote. It's on his website, and we're going to explain the whole thing to make it a little bit more comfortable. We've been talking about tariffs for a while, and we're going to talk about it. So, he wrote on his website, and he sent it to me to explain to the pot, to our listeners, is due to the elimination of the $800 de minimis exemption, Maritime Knife Supply is only selling the products made in the United States, Canada, or Mexico to the United States to avoid additional tariffs and brokerage fees to our customers in the United States. And so what that means is, and this is something he and I talked about during at Blade Show, is what the tariffs aren't about things going across the border. The tariffs are based off of the country of origin. The tariffs are based off of the country of origin of the product they're selling. Okay. So at Maritime Knife Supply, if you go to the Maritime Knife Supply, if you're an American and he sells a lot of stuff to Americans, he has a lot of options, and a lot of those options are made in the United States. I believe like Norton belts and stuff like that. If you want to get some Razor Stars, that's the way to go. You get them from Maritime, and you will be exempt from the tariffs, the 800 de minimis exemption. I have an article about that. But like he sells steel from the New Jersey Steel Baron, and a lot of the steel, like the stainless stuff, comes from Europe. So even though he bought it from New Jersey Steel Baron, it came from the United States, their country of origin is from Sweden or Germany or whatever. And he is basically stopped selling any of those products that are not American, Mexican, or Canadian made, selling in the United States. So like, for example, he sent me a message saying basically the inventory options for Americans went from 3,600 different products to 350. So holy, you can buy stuff if you're in the United States. You can buy stuff off the website, which you should. If you're listening to this and you want to support our guy, if you're an American, you want to support our guy, who Maritime Knife Supply is unbelievable for this reason. Yeah. I mean, he's put so much time, energy, and money into American businesses and American schools. He's involved with the New England School of Metalwork. He's also involved with the Center for Metal Arts. And he does a lot for American, you know, craftspeople. For that reason alone, you should just be loyal to him because he puts it back. So, so he has it on the website. You can still buy from him. Go to maritimeknifesupply.com. And then if you're in the United States, you'll be, he's basically figured out which you can buy, which you can't buy. So, definitely support him. And what's interesting is earlier this week, I started to hear from our, Australian friends that the Australian Postal Service is no longer going to be shipping from Australia to the United States.
I just saw Jason Ellard posted something about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, this is something that's, so I got an article about what's going on in what this all means. So what I gather is because, you know, anything that's going to be tariffed is a lot of paperwork plus whatever the tariff is. So like the Canadian Post, or I'm not sure if it's the Canadian Post, but I know that Australia, Japan, and then a few EU countries' postal services are just not shipping packages to the United States. I don't know about like personal mail and stuff like that, but they've had it. I would think that a lot of it's because they probably don't have the infrastructure to deal with all the paperwork of tariffs. But what Maritime Knife Supply was referring to, this $800 de minimis exemption. So yeah. I found an article called "The Rule That Many Online Purchases Dirt Cheap for United States Consumers Is Now Ending." So this is the reason why you're going to be not getting a lot of stuff coming over here. For nearly a century, the de minimis trade exemption let people skip import fees for shipping small stuff. But after the U.S. raised its limit to $800, that small stuff became big business, driven by online shopping. We're talking about 4 million in de minimis packages being processed a day, says Courtney Griffin of the Consumer Federation of America. The de minimis rule also became increasingly contentious. Backers say it brings low prices to consumers, but critics say the rule hurts U.S. companies, allows unsafe or illegal items to be imported without close customs inspection. Sweeping changes are arriving Friday. That's the 29th. That's when this is happening with Maritime Knife Supply. That's when this is happening. So sweeping changes arriving Friday when the President Trump executive order suspending the de minimis rule for all U.S. imports take effect. The shift is already rippling around the world. From Asia to Europe, shipping services are pausing their deliveries to the U.S., saying they need time to figure out how to revamp their paperwork and payment processes. So what is this? What will doing away with de minimis mean for consumers? Here's a quick guide. Does this make sense so far?
I think so.
What part doesn't make sense?
I don't know. Just keep going.
All right. De minimis is Latin for trifling or little of importance, dating back. It was never meant to be for commercial import route. In its first decades, the U.S. de minimis threshold used to be $200. That is, packages worth $200 or less were not subject to taxes and tariffs. But in 2016, the country raised the threshold sharply to $800, one of the highest in the world. The spike came out of the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act signed by President Barack Obama. Online retailers and express delivery companies backed the change. You are now sort of creating this loophole to all the normal custom rules, including inspection. The shift eased the way for importation of products that would have otherwise faced hurdles, she says, from safety standards to endangering species laws and ban. After 2016, the shift started to dominate cargo entering the United States. The number of shipments grew from 140 million shipments in 2014 to 1.36 billion in 2024.
Go ahead. So this rule has made it more advantageous for companies to import things. Without having to pay.
You have a higher threshold, the higher dollar value threshold before tariffs and these custom taxes.
Okay, so that is going up even higher now?
No, they're getting rid of it. They're getting rid of it altogether. So anything that comes in,
no matter how much volume or what the price, it's going to get
tariffed. So the whole point was, is anything under $800 could go through without the tariffs, which made things a lot easier. But now they're getting rid of the whole thing. It used to be 200, now it's 800. Then it was 800, now it's going to be nothing. So everything's going to be tariffed. Everything of value, a consumer product going into the United States is going to be tariffed. So it makes it very difficult for these small things to, let's say you buy a stick of Damasteel, and then, you maybe pay customs, but you're not going to, now it's going to be, whatever the customs of the Sweden, it might be 50%. So the issue is like all these companies like Maritime Knife Supply now would have to do a ton of paperwork that they're not prepared for. And that now, like the same thing is happening with Australian knife makers. Australian knife makers, Mert Tansu was saying that 70% of his customers are United States. So he can't use Australian Post. So now everybody's going to be leaning on DHL, FedEx, all those private shipping companies, but it's going to be like five times more expensive and it's going to be slower because now all of a sudden you don't have the Australian post office doing all the heavy lifting. Now everyone's going to be going to DHL.
Right.
So all these postal companies are like, fuck this. We're not prepared for this. We don't have the paperwork. We don't have the manpower. The United States Postal Service has been cutting the workforce for years, and it's like everyone's going to be too burdened, and the whole idea is to prevent people from really. I mean, it's going to be hurting a lot of overseas businesses like Maritime Knife Supply that deal with American companies, American small guys like us, and it's going to probably be tough for Damasteel. I'm supposed to talk to Carolee in regards to that. So it's a fucking bad spot for a lot of makers. And here's the problem. Now this is the other part of it that we talk about, the maker community, the knife making community in terms of their business. You guys got to start to read the tea leaves and look at the economy, look at the world economy. I talk to three guys across the globe usually like once a week or so, and we kind of talk about what's going on in the world. And I read the paper and try to like forecast. And I talk to my steel providers in regards to, is there going to be steel scarcity? That's something that, it might be a problem. Or what's going to happen with these tariffs? And when they start to buy, when you talk about, buying steel, guys like the New Jersey Steel Baron, they're not buying one sheet of steel. They're buying pallets of steel. So when it comes to the point where they're down to the point where they're ready to buy more steel from Germany or Sweden or wherever it is, they're going to also have to take care of those tariffs as well. So you're going to have to think about the future of where am I at for 2026 and start to really think instead of worrying about what's going to happen for Christmas, you need to start thinking past Christmas and figuring out what we're going to do, especially if the prices of steel go up, which they will. You know what I'm saying? But at the same time,
sorry.
Yeah, you're muted. Sorry, I don't know if you're talking. But do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I guess what's always confused me about a lot of this kind of chaos with the tariffs and shit like that is that it's also like it's really fucking with even large businesses.
Yeah.
And it's and so much of, I think, at least in the United States, a lot of industry and companies are built off the manufacturing of products. Like, they're American companies designing and designing products, but then having them manufactured overseas,
right,
and then having them imported. And it's like, is this some weird drive to force American, like, to reinvigorate the American manufacturing? Like, what is this? Or is it just, like, some weird chaos, like the last time the tariffs went up to, like, 150% or something like that from, I think, something like 25%, only to be dropped down, like, another, like, a month later.
See, this
to
is the
30%.
Problem.
And it's like, what is happening? Like, are they preparing for something weird like that?
The funny thing is, and we never talk about politics. In my personal opinion, I don't think any of these political issues are black and white, yes or no, or right or wrong. Sure. I think that I live in the gray area, so I agree with a lot of sides, both sides, in regards to what's going on. I think American manufacturing is great. I think the problem is in this situation where you're trying to deal with trying to build American manufacturing, you can't punish the small manufacturers.
The existing system, yeah.
So if we want to try to build, you know, I've talked about, you know, Josh Smith did a whole episode. We talked about this a couple weeks ago about this tariffs. Now it's going to hurt him because, like, he's trying to build this whole big facility in Montana and do Montana Knife Company, and he's employing employees and he's trying to make the American dream happen of small manufacturing, but the tariffs are going to fucking burn him. And it's like, you know, this is the reason why it drives me crazy when I'm talking to these kind of, it gets to the point where you start to see that more knife makers are more hobbyists than the willingness to understand that this is business. And if you're looking for the longevity of your business, you have to start to think about this stuff. And I worry for my friends, our friends in Australia who, you know, like Mertz, he's got 70% of his business is in the United States. Now, all of a sudden, you know, shipping is a giant problem. We've been saying this for years. For me to send something to Europe, it makes it not worth buying, you know, because it's just such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And now the same thing is going to happen to a lot of people. I know that, and I'm probably going to be talking to Tomer. I talked to Tomer a couple of days ago, and he's on vacation with his family. But we were talking about a lot of the stuff. We were talking about steel scarcity. We're talking about and that is going to be a thing, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you're going to wake up one morning and you're going to realize that, like, you're going to call your company up, and their company's going to say, "Hey, maybe you should consider this other steel that you should try to use, maybe, because we don't have any more of, you know, the one that you like so much."
Yeah.
And there's going to be those real issues of trying to be like, okay, I want to be this artisan, and I have these high standards for my business, and I have these high standards for my knives, and I only accept the best. And then all of a sudden, it's just like, well, you know, there are other factors in here that you're really kind of neglecting, and now you're just going to, you know, you're going to have to really refigure what you're doing. And that's what we're doing. I mean, I just invested in a lot of steel, frankly, this past week. I invested not even steel blanks to cut. I bought sheets of steel, and then they're going to be sitting there. And when I need them, I know that I'll have them, and I have enough steel for through to 2026.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, to help provide, especially with the example of Josh, I think a lot of people will be like, well, he talks about American made all the time. Isn't his stuff American made? And it is, but the steel that he's using, the material that is going onto the handles, or even the hardware that's going into the handles, those are products that he's purchasing from within the United States, but they come from other places outside of the United States. And those products are now going to cost a lot more, if not become more scarce, causing their costs to go up way a ton before. And that's going to affect his, I guess, yeah. If he continues to make the knives the way that he's making them, it's gonna affect their price dramatically.
Just to kind of break in a little bit, I don't know what he buys and where he buys it. Sure. I'll say for myself, I've talked to every single one of my suppliers. My G10, I don't use Chinese G10. I use all American G10 that's made in the United States. I use Total Boat Epoxy made in Rhode Island. The only thing, and then even, you know, even all my, you know, every, all the stuff that I use, all the pieces that I use, and the Corby bolts are made, Jan Supply makes the Corby bolts.
Sure.
And they make them in-house. So that's made in the United States. The only thing I don't have is steel made in the United States.
Right.
So that's the one thing that, like, I think that, you know, at some point we're going to have to, you know,
that's
down
fair.
The line. But at the same time, it's like I've been thinking about that for a couple of years now in regards to, because I have been concerned about the global, these global issues, and I know that we've had this problem. But
well, but then the other side of it becomes, okay, great. There are sources within the United States to make these products, companies that can manufacture these products. But what happens when they become the only option? As businesses, it is not in their best interest. Like, supply and demand is a real economic principle, right? And if they're the only resources or one of very few resources, the amount of competition goes down severely, which allows them to push the cost up. It would make sense as a business. They're not in the business to, like, I think a lot of company or manufacturers are trying to help people, but at the same time they're trying to make money on their business. They have shareholders or investors that they have to report back to continue to show growth. And that is also, just because there are sources within the United States does not mean that those United States resources or manufacturers are our friends.
No, of course,
necessarily. And so, and I think I would be very nervous as well about what companies within the United States are going to do in regards to the cost of their products once the competition of companies outside of the United States is either severely depleted or eliminated entirely.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because number one is we also have been depending on cheap goods for a long time. And the point, when you think about, you know, even we made jokes about the fact that toxic things that people say, and they say, why is that knife so expensive? I get mine $20 on Amazon. We're so used to this cheap shit that we expect it, right? And we don't think about the fact that what is American manufacturing? It's not only are you creating a product you're proud of, but you're also providing jobs. Like, I have, you know, one of the things I'm proud of is I'm not like Josh. I don't have 100 employees or 150, whatever you got. But I have a lot of American employees, and then I've never bounced a check. I've always, you know, been very supportive of the people in my shop. I have definitely not taken vacations when I should have, because I felt as though if I'm not in the shop, and I have to close the shop down, people lose money. And I believe in the American dream of having a job where you can have a fair wage and maybe some health insurance, and then you can kind of go forward. I feel very strongly about that. The problem is we need more. You need more people to kind of feel the same way. So I think that it's interesting. I think that what's more scary is I've been talking with Lawrence about this for the past few weeks, and now all the knife makers in Australia got the letter from the post office, you know, Monday, and it's like this de minimis exemption is gone on the August 29th, and everyone's like ever waking up to this now. Which is, you know, just fucking, it's just fucking annoying. It's fucking annoying because it's just like, don't you guys like read the paper? Don't you look at what's going on in the world? Don't you kind of try to do any type of forecasting for your business? I feel terrible for these guys. I feel terrible for Lawrence. Lawrence has been talking to me about this shit for a while now. He's been freaking out. He has never freaked out. He's on top of all this, but it's a lot of pivoting for him to do what he's doing. Not to mention our friends at Damasteel. Like, what's going to happen with the Damasteel build along? Now, all the Damasteel for the build along went to Maritime Knife Supply. So is that going to, you know, if you haven't gotten your build along billets, you got to reach out to Maritime, and maybe he won't be able to move them anymore. You know,
that means our Canadian constituency needs to fucking step it up. Come on, guys.
Dude, if you're Canadian, if you're Canadian and American, if you're Canadian, you better fucking get that wallet out, get your crowbar out, get your fucking wallet, open that fucking dusty ass wallet, and start spending some money with our man Lawrence Lake Maritime Knife Supply. Period. And then also go get yourself some Damascus. So if you're in Europe, and you're not worried about them tariffs, go support our friends at Damasteel. The Damasteel Invitational is still happening, and we're excited about it. And we're going to, I think it's happening in November. We're really excited about that. And if you go to damasteel.se, you can see all the great pattern welded stainless steel they have. And then you can follow them on Damasteel. And when you go to damasteel.se, you put in the, you fill out the paperwork and you put in the promo code KnifeTalk10 for 10% off Damasteel. But they're made in Sweden, so I'm not 100% sure what's going to happen with them either. Look, it's this strange... that's everybody. Oh, and I got to hit one more. But it's a very, very strange time. And I think the one thing I hear... We've been hearing about this on this podcast. We get messages from people and they say that I don't like to do this part of this business. I don't like to do the same thing, or I don't have motivation. I don't have, you better fucking figure it out, because there's going to be forces that are going to be working against you and you have to figure out how to pivot.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, it's going to be a question of hunger. Like, are you hungry enough to keep this up and figure out how to make this work or not? And that's the issue. Otherwise, I'm going to be seeing, I was talking to a good friend of mine who is listening to this podcast right now out in the Pacific Northwest, smart guy. He says, I've seen a lot of grinders on the Facebook marketplace where I'm at. People are starting to sell their stuff. So.
Up in the Pacific. I'm up here. Is that me? Am I sending those?
No, it wasn't you. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it off air. I got a couple things I got to talk to you about off air anyway.
Yeah,
but no one's in trouble, by the way. But then, sure, with that said, if you are going to get a grinder, you got to support our guys at Broadbeck Ironworks, broadbeckironworks.com. Ryan, they just moved into a new big shop, and I'm very proud for them. They're doing American manufacturing, and they're great. And if the 2x72 grinder is my favorite, I love their grinder. I love their attachments. I love their customer service. I love I love everything about them. Ryan is fantastic. And Ben and all them, they're great. And if you go to broadbeckironworks.com, put in the promo code KnifeTalk10, you can get 10% off their attachments, their packages, and all that. So, did that get grim, that business talk?
No, I think it's necessary. And if anybody's got a problem with it, then you suck it the fuck up.
Whoa.
It's part of the fucking reality that the world we're living in, especially knife. And I know we're here to make people laugh and stuff, but these are things that we should be taking into consideration.
I had a conversation with my steel provider. I had read some things, and then I saw you know, Australians were really in a bad spot.
Yeah.
And I decided to call up some steel providers and talk to them. And they were far more concerned with, and I'm not trying to scare everybody, but they were far more concerned with steel scarcity. And then on top of the fact that most of the steel that we're using, stainless steels and stuff like that, are made in Europe. And that they're going to be, when these big companies who distribute the steel are buying the pallets of steel, they're going to be subject to the, you know, tariffs, and then Germany and Sweden are 50%. Yeah. So they're going to pass that on. And the harder part is having to figure out how to deal with, because they're not going to close their shop up. They're going to have to deal, and they're going to have to pass that on, that 50% on to the consumer. Yeah. But the question is, you know, what happens if we can't get it? They got to run around to find other people to make the steel they want. And they're not making a lot of this steel. I don't know where premium American stainless steel is being made. Is it being made? Do you know anything about it?
Yeah. I mean, we have the... what the fuck is it called? the stuff that Larry Thomas is... Magnica is being made in U.S.
Is that Niagara?
Niagara. Niagara Steel rolls it. And I think Crucible Steel, or whoever owns Crucible Steel now, is manufacturing it, and Niagara rolls it and distributes it. And then there's another steel that just came out that's like it's a 15 and 20 analog that's good for being used in Damascus. I outside of that, I mean, there's 154 cm. There's, I mean, This is all the M series steels. There are some companies who have who are importers, major importers of foreign steels. How much inventory they actually have right now is obviously another question. Because there's companies like Admiral Steel, I'm sure has tons of material, but
I wouldn't be so sure. I've used to use Admiral all the time, and they would run out of specific stocks based on demand. So, like sizes, that this is the issue with, like, you know, especially different sizes. Like if you have a specific thickness, they're going to stock. And Admiral's great, and New Jersey Steel Baron's great too. Admiral stopped stocking certain sizes, and it got to the point where I was like. Because I like the pricing of the 440C there, but they stop with the certain, you know, certain, you know. So then it gets to the point where it's just like, now what happens? You know, even New Jersey Steel Baron, they'll stop a certain size just because they've run out, and then all of a sudden there's no demand. So why would I buy a fucking pallet of it from wherever?
Well,
so this is you know, and that's the other thing. It's going to be like, you know, you're going to have to start to do R&D. I was talking to my friend. I mentioned this, and we're going to get the fuck out of here at some point. I told you, I guess in the spring, I have a friend who works on Wall Street. I talk to often, and he said to me in the early spring, I said to him, well, when everyone was freaking out, probably was that April, people were freaking out.
Yeah.
And it was also very slow, by the way. It was and I'm talking to globally, knife guys globally. It was April was very slow. And I was talking to my friend on Wall Street, and I said, well, what are you saying? Because he's been on Wall Street for fucking 30 years. Guys, like, he, you know, advises people in regards to the, you know, forecasts and stuff like that. And he said, at the time, he said, the biggest thing we're noticing is companies that do premium dog food are really doing bad numbers. And I said, well, why is that? And he goes, well, I'm only saying that because it's a luxury item that people don't necessarily need. They go back to fucking Purina. They go down back to the puppy chow. They don't need the fucking gourmet. Right. Yeah. They don't need the gourmet. He's like, and that's what we're forecasting for a lot of companies is you should think about there's going to be a lot of economic uncertainty in the next 6 months. This was back in April. So April, May, June, July, August. We're in there. The next 6 months, there's going to be a lot of economic instability. So you're going to need to, what he said to me is like, you should hold what you got. Don't spend unnecessarily. Try to work with what you have, and then, you know, try to, you know, make plans to advance and hold on, get stuff before, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. And that's what I've done. And I actually bought 2 loads of steel in the past 3 months, 2 months, 2 loads of steel, way more steel than I would have last year. No, I don't have a question. And some of it was, you know, to have stock in stock for and through Christmas. And then this last batch was just like just buying the raw steel and just putting it away for a rainy day.
I guess.
But it's, you know, this is how you got to operate, and it isn't fun. This is the stuff that the people say that I don't like to not have fun.
Yeah. It's tricky. Not the funnest for sure.
Well, look, but I mean, you got to move. The key is it's not all doom and gloom. The key is this is problem solving. This is what blacksmiths, bladesmiths, knife makers, this is makers do, is your problem solving, and you should enjoy the problem solving.
Yeah.
The last thing is I still get messages from knife makers, and I know I'm speaking to the fucking, you know, I'm speaking to the blind, the deaf. I still get knife makers who send me messages asking me to walk them through handhold and walk them through certain processes, you know, heat treatment, how you do the, I don't need the exact thing in heat treatment. I need exact how you do their serrations. And it's back to something that we've always said, which is these knife makers are they're too cheap to buy experience. They're not willing. They don't want to lose money for a minute. They don't see that that experience is valuable. And these are the guys who are going to like Schreigevault when all of a sudden they can't get what they want. And then, you know, they're going to blame the internet. They're going to blame the Trump administration. They're going to blame, you know, this, that, the other thing. And they're not going to problem solve.
Sure. Yeah.
That's my TED talk.
That's your TED talk. Well, yeah.
Ah, look, guys, I don't mean to fucking, we're going to end the show. We're going to bring it up. We're going to bring it up.
Let's do it.
We're going to bring it up. Guys, I'm going to bring it up right now. Guys, thank you so much. Send us your messages. We're going to have Craig back next week. I'm sure he's going to call me the C word. And then you'll hear that then. So in the meantime, send your messages to Knife Talk Podcast Instagram. I would love to hear your opinions. If you don't send me the Magna Carta, I do not want the Magna Carta. And that means don't send me like the fucking, you know, the Treaty of Worms. Don't give me the whole fucking thing. Don't give me verses and chapters and ums and ahs. And it got to be readable. So if you want to write something, you want to send a message in regards to tariffs, you want to send a message in, by all means, Knife Talk Podcast Instagram. And I want you to do this last thing. Support our sponsors. Support our sponsors. Support our sponsors. All right, guys. We'll see you next week. What are you watching?
I started watching the Outlander series actually again.
Is that with the old one from the 80s?
What? Oh, you're thinking
Outlander was the original.
You're thinking of Highlander.
Yeah, I liked Highlander.
Highlander. Yeah, there's a new movie coming out too, right?
I have no idea.
I can't remember. It's a new movie or a new series. But no, this is not
Immortals.
This is not Highlander. This is a series written by a woman named Diana Gabaldon. Essentially, it's a romance novel series, but it's like histio romance kind of shit. It's smut, and it got turned into a TV show, and it's interesting. It's good, and it's smutty.
Oh, smutty!
Yeah.
Whoa, yeah. Smutty's good. I ain't mad about that.
I know you're a big fan of the 50 Shades stuff.
No, I don't like that. I can't. I don't like that stuff. I don't like all that fucking that 50 Shades where they're all beating each other up and boning, and that doesn't interest me at all. Just fucking tying people up and all that shit. That's a fucking doesn't interest me at all.
Different strokes.
Apparently, you can watch it with your friend Rosie Palms. You know what I'm saying?
Rosie Palmer.
Rosie Palms and her five sisters. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah,
jerking off, roughing off the suspect with Rosie Palms and her five sisters. I got you. Listen to me. I am with you. I have been watching. I'll tell you one thing. I wish Craig was here just so I could fucking beat his ass up a little bit. I've been watching the U.S. Open because when I was growing up, my mother loved the U.S. Open. And that was also when the U.S. Open came on. That was when we knew we were going back to school. So it's the week before Labor Day and then usually go back to school after Labor Day. But I remember that was to me marked, you know. You know, it was
summer.
All 24 hours a day of the U.S. Open. My mom used to go to the U.S. Open, and it was and so. Last year, this time we were in Sweden. We were at Tormek, and we were visiting them, and we were in the hotel, and they had the U.S. Open on, so we were watching the U.S. Open. So Hillary and I had a good time. We came home, and then we made this drink. There, you know what the famous drink over at the U.S. Open is this year. It's called the Honey Deuce. You know what the Honey Deuce is? I told about it last year. Deuce is not just poop. You know, it's a tennis word for deuce is like when 40-40 is deuce. And so it's vodka, lemonade, and like Chambord or like raspberry liqueur. And then they make these honeydew melon balls that look like tennis balls, and they float them on the top.
So
It happens to be an awesome drink. So we're making them and all that. I've been watching the U.S. Open, and when I'll say this, I will say this proudly. Tennis players, in general, are some of the biggest whiny bitches in all of sports. And I don't think there anybody bitches and complains like a tennis player. They're entitled.
You never watch soccer?
I don't give a fuck about soccer. The flopping, I don't give a fuck about that. I'm telling you, per capita.
You ever seen LeBron James play basketball?
let me talk. We could do the whole thing on flopping. Like, I think that flopping in basketball, flopping in basketball is a technique to get possession of the ball. No question about it. And my man, Jalen Brunson of the New York Knicks, is the flop master general. He hunt and flops. I know all about it. But in tennis, they bitch and they cry. And when the game's over, they're screaming at each other and they're cursing out the referee and they're crying and they're bitching and they're smashing their tennis rackets on the ground and they're cursing people. It's like, I think per capita, they're less tennis players, professional tennis players than there are soccer players. So per capita, tennis players are the biggest whiny bitches out there.
I
entitled.
You. They get the title. All right.
Entitled. They're entitled. They just had this whole thing, you know, one thing happens and I'm getting all these videos of these tennis players acting like just spoiled brats. So I always look forward to that. That's what I like.
Flailing. What do you call it? Flailing around.
Oh yeah, they're flailing around. Yeah. No question about it. They're flopping, they're flailing, they're throwing themselves around. They're carrying on, as my father used to say. They're carrying on. They're Schreigevaulting. They're Schreigevaulting, guys. All right, I think we've done enough.
Okay.
All right. You good? Did I bump you out?
No. I'm good. Right. Yeah, and if anybody wants to learn more about Damascus and see the shit I've been doing on the Patreon, go check it out and sign up. Love to have you there.
Pay him. Pay the man.
There's
pay
actually
the man.
A free level, but I would appreciate the support.
Don't fucking tell him that. He's freeloading flea bags.
The reason I would appreciate the support, because it really helps drive my ability to afford to take the time to do all the extra stuff of filming and editing and all that shit.
Get in there, guys. It's enough already. All right. It's enough already is the answer. We will see you next week, guys. Craig will be back. By hook or by crook, and we will see you next week. Mareko, thank you.
Peace and love.
Peace and love.
What if you could design your own dental implant system from scratch? What would you change? Less complexity? Better bone preservation? Simpler digital workflows? A price that actually makes sense? That's exactly what Biotech Dental created with the Contact Dental Implant System. Contact implants promote osseointegration, preserve crestal bone, and simplify your implant procedures. With a single prosthetic connection, streamlined surgical kits, and seamless integration into digital workflows, the Contact Dental implant is quickly becoming the go-to choice for U.S. dental professionals. Your cases will be supported by a dedicated planning team who can provide surgical guides and answer any technical questions. Experience the difference firsthand. Biotech Dental will provide your first contact implant case completely free, including restorative components and surgical planning support. Clinically proven, intuitively designed, surprisingly affordable, discover why so many dentists are switching to the contact implant system. Visit biotechdentalusa.com to learn more.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.